This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Society for History and Racial Equity holds the annual Summit on Racism in Kalamazoo tomorrow. Coming up, we'll talk with SHARE's Executive Director, Donna Odom. But first, when a private donation and plans for a new foundation were announced to help stabilize the city of Kalamazoo's finances and address long-term problems, it did not take long for comparisons to be made to the Kalamazoo Promise. Michelle Miller Adams is the author of two books about the Promise and other scholarship programs. She's also written a book on helping people out of poverty. She's a research fellow at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo and a political science professor at Grand Valley State University. Michelle Miller Adams, thank you for being here again.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, I think our listeners by now know that you have studied extensively the Kalamazoo Promise, as well as some of the other scholarship programs which have come about as a result. What similarities do you see between the Kalamazoo Promise and the Foundation for Excellence that the city of Kalamazoo is trying to get started?
Well, you've put your finger on one of the most important ones in your introduction, and that this is, and that's a private donation that comes from wealthy individuals within our community, and it is not something that there is any indication these donors want to manage or be involved in any kind of hands-on way. So I think of it as kind of both the Kalamazoo Promise and the Foundation for Excellence are large, quite open-ended philanthropic commitments where the donors have essentially handed off responsibility for the operations to existing entities. In the case of the Kalamazoo Promise, it's the Kalamazoo Promise Scholarship Organization. In the case of Foundation for Excellence, it is the city. Another similarity is that both contributions, both donations, represent investments in the urban core of our region. The Kalamazoo Promise funds are directed to graduates of the Kalamazoo Public Schools, which is the school district that serves our urban population, most of our low-income kids, most of our minority kids. The Foundation for Excellence is a donation directed to an even smaller entity, the city of Kalamazoo itself, which is, again, at the urban core of our region, the home to many of the low-income folks in our community and many of the minority families. Their goal, I think, is similar, which is a goal of increasing the attractiveness of the city on the one hand and the school district on the other hand, strengthening those systems, making them better able to retain and attract new students, new families, new investment, new businesses. And both of them, I think, embody a combination of economic development and poverty alleviation motivations, which we can get into a little bit later. They are both very long-term investments. These are, I mean, in some sense, the Foundation for Excellence is a quick fix. It's a quick fix of some urgent, immediate problems. But these are both longer-term investments that are people are counting on to endure through generations, essentially. And they're going to depend on the support of the community to make them work. So I think those are some key similarities between the two investments.
And if you had to point out some important differences, what would those be?
Well, one important difference is the nature of the investment. The Kalamazoo Promise, I think of as a human capital investment, money that's committed to help enrich the human capital of young people in our region. The Foundation for Excellence may have some human capital components, but it's also definitely going to have some infrastructure components as well, as the city uses it to close the gap in infrastructure spending that has opened up over the years, as well as what is already, I think, quite well known about the Foundation for Excellence, which is a reduction in the property tax rates that are paid by homeowners in the city. Another important difference is that the Foundation for Excellence donation is not an anonymous donation. I have heard rumors that the donors perhaps wanted it to be anonymous, intended it to be anonymous, but that isn't really workable when you're donating money to a public entity. There are Freedom of Information Act rights and rules that govern knowledge about where your public funding is coming from. So the fact that it's not an anonymous donation does open up some potential for conflicts of interest, which I don't think are going to arise, but certainly have been discussed in the run-up to this. Another really important difference is that the Foundation for Excellence is providing funding for something that the public sector is supposed to provide, fixing our roads, investing in infrastructure, keeping property tax rates at a reasonable level. And the Kalamazoo Promise is different because as much as I think it's critical to our community's future, it is kind of an add-on. The public sector does not have a commitment to allow students to go to college tuition-free.
Every city has roads
to deal with, but
it's not necessarily the case that any school district before 2005 was really setting up a scholarship program. There were a few maybe, right, but not very well known and not in the way the Kalamazoo Promise was doing it.
Right. I should add, going back to similarities for a moment, that both of these investments are hugely innovative. They are really kind of first in the field. There were a few precedents for the Kalamazoo Promise. They were quite small. They were not well known. But both this private funding directed toward a city and the scholarship funding through the Kalamazoo Promise are hugely innovative and provide potentially very powerful models to other communities.
I noted that you've written a book about, of course, you've written two books on the Kalamazoo Promise, and you also have a book about trying to get people out of poverty. That is one of the stated goals of the Foundation for Excellence. How would you say if you take that money and you're going to try, you know, it's not going to be all of it, but you're going to take some of that money and say, okay, we want to move people out of poverty. And obviously, you know, it would seem to me that the goal there is to move them into a position where they can hold a job, where they can, you know, pay their own bills, et cetera. What's the way to do that? What are the programs that you would want to put in place?
Mm-hmm. So I don't have really specific answers to that. It's not really my place, and I don't have the power to make those specific answers come true. But I have thought a lot about some sort of guiding principles when it comes to the use of the money. There are many programs that work to alleviate poverty and to build human assets, economic assets for low-income individuals and communities. And one of the great things is that we, as a field in social science, we know what works. The federal government keeps something called a What Works Clearinghouse. Really tough to get in there if you're a social program. You have to meet extremely high standards of causality and evidence. There are nonprofits that focus on evidence-based change. Rigorous evaluations have been done of many programs that are set up to address poverty. So it's not like we don't know how to do it. One of the problems is that many of these programs cost a fair amount of money. And to the extent that they've been tried in our community, they are often quite partial. There are very few slots available. They are underfunded. I'm thinking, for example, about a program called the Nurse Family Partnership, which we have here in Kalamazoo County. It's thought of as a highly effective strategy for getting low-income parents, low-income mothers with new children on a path towards success for their children, school readiness, better financial outcomes. It is a program that works, but it is a program that doesn't reach everybody who needs it. Another program where there is a lot of evidence about the importance of it and how to do it right is childcare and preschool. So we have expanded preschool slots in our community, but we are certainly not covering everybody yet. So I think that one of the important principles in thinking about the use of this money is not to reinvent the wheel, not to go out and say, we have to figure out from scratch how to make this happen and, you know, what works to alleviate poverty, what works to rebuild neighborhoods, what works to reduce crime. There are a lot of tested strategies out there. So I think it's going to involve building on best practices, not just programs that exist in our community, but best practices that have been used elsewhere, and then bringing them into our community at scale so they really reach everybody, dare I say everybody, who needs them, which would be really something quite new in the delivery of social programs in our community.
Is Kalamazoo maybe a little different place than some other cities in terms of the generosity, the resources available to start something like this that maybe another city might not be in quite the position to do what Kalamazoo is trying to accomplish here?
I think it may be. I encounter people all the time who say about the Kalamazoo Promise, well, we can't do that here. We don't have anonymous billionaires who can fund it. We don't have the resources here. But in reality, almost 100 communities have set up some kind of place-based scholarship program inspired by the Kalamazoo Promise. Most of them are not as generous as the Promise. They are different in structure, but they're really trying to accomplish the same thing based on the local assets that they do have deployed in strategic ways in response to their local needs. So I think maybe a few years ago, I would have said, oh, no, other people won't be able to do this. But having seen this kind of experimentation that's gone on with the place-based scholarship model, I'm thinking, you know, maybe communities would be able to innovate in similar ways with different sources of money, different levels of money. We have a unique opportunity here in Kalamazoo. We can model social change and what it means to be a progressive, inclusive, economically successful community at the local level. I think when the Kalamazoo Promise donors created the Kalamazoo Promise, they had no idea that the Kalamazoo Promise was going to become a model for communities elsewhere. And I don't think that was part of their goal. I think they feel the same way about this as well. But in reality, if we do this well, if we do this work effectively, we certainly could become a model for other communities.
So why do you believe it's the case that Kalamazoo is in this position where they are turning to private donations? And we should note here that there are other cities which are also facing financial struggles. How did we reach this point?
Well, we have, as a city, struggled financially, as have other cities in Michigan and in many, many other states, particularly in the upper Midwest and northeastern parts of the country, where we have faced challenges around demographic decline and out-migration from the region. But we have more specific reasons for why we are in trouble. One reason that is, at least in our region, quite specific to Kalamazoo relative to its suburbs is that the city of Kalamazoo contains a high proportion of tax-exempt property. I'm sitting on the campus of Western Michigan University. The colleges, the museums, the concert halls, the churches, the nonprofit organizations, the tax-exempt organizations are clustered in the city, although they serve the region. What that does is it takes a big chunk of land, about a third, just under a third of usable land, out of the property tax equation. And that means that the homeowners in the city of Kalamazoo, of which I am one, pay extra high taxes for the privilege of living in this urban core. And it's especially tricky because you can live any number of places and be quite close to the urban core, but not pay the city of Kalamazoo taxes. So that's a special problem, but that is certainly not the only problem we face. We share a problem with other municipalities throughout the state of Michigan, which is a quite dramatic decline in transfers from the state to localities. This is a problem that's been going on for probably about 20 years. The number of people who work for the city of Kalamazoo has fallen by a third over the past 20 years at a time when the need for city services has gone up. A really important part of this Foundation for Excellence, probably the most immediate part, is going to be a property tax abatement, a reduction in property taxes of about 37% city property taxes for homeowners, as well as trying to catch up a little bit with those infrastructure shortfalls that we've been experiencing, things like parks, safer streets, neighborhood infrastructure.
You noted that one of the similarities between this and the Kalamazoo Promise is that the donors don't seem to be hands-on. But at the same time, we do know the initial $70 million is coming from Bill Johnston and Bill Parfit. And is there a legitimate concern that now, since we know who these people are, that anything they say in a public setting, Bill Johnston's on, you know, the Board of Trustees here at Western Michigan University leading the search for the next president, that if he says something offhand in a public setting, someone may hear it and they may say, oh, well, I think Bill Johnston wants us to do this, even if that's not his intention and even if he's not trying to drive things that way. Does that perhaps influence this in ways that are not intended and may not be the leading us towards a desired outcome?
I think that's a great point, and I think that is the point that some of the commissioners who had their reservations about this gift, one of the things that they were concerned about. But I don't know if this makes people feel better or worse. I would say that people probably were paying a lot of attention to what Bill Johnston and Bill Parfit were saying before the Foundation for Excellence donation. We know who in this community has money. We know that money often correlates with seats on boards and an outsized role and influence in the community. And I would say, compared to some other communities that I've lived in and looked at, our donors are a pretty low-key bunch. They don't really go out a lot and say, here's my money and this is what I want. They do have influence when they want to get something done. They have, you know, privileged avenues through which to get that done. But I'm not sure that this particular donation really changes that landscape that much.
I want to note that you have been working on a study comparing philanthropy in Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids, which is to be released sometime in the near future. I'm just wondering if this particular donation and the effort to launch the foundation tells us something that kind of fits in with that overall picture of how philanthropy works in Kalamazoo.
I think it does. I mean, it changes a little bit some of the patterns that we've seen in the past in Kalamazoo. We haven't seen a lot of philanthropic investment in Kalamazoo in infrastructure. We don't have buildings that donors paid for and that bear people's names. To the extent that buildings are named in Kalamazoo, they tend to be these sort of honorific names. The new medical school is named after Homer Stryker, and the downtown campus is named after W.E. Upjohn. Neither of them are alive.
Of Homer Stryker,
right.
His descendants, provided a large contribution that allowed that to be built.
Yes, and they also, I believe that the building was purchased from MPI dollar, right? But if you look historically at recent history of philanthropic efforts to revitalize Kalamazoo, they haven't been largely infrastructure driven. They tend to be a little bit more educational, health industry, human capital type investments. And this donation is a little different because it is going to be used to make up for some of those infrastructure shortfalls that we've experienced in Kalamazoo. So, you know, it changes the complexion a little bit. But I think this idea of investing local, wealthy individuals who have stayed local, who've made their money locally, and whose economic fortunes rest on the future of the city of Kalamazoo, investing in making their community a better place, not just for their own economic interests, but because they live here. And this is a place they care about, and at least part of their families live here. I think philanthropy often blends both self-interested and altruistic motives together.
Enlightened
self-interest and you know, pure goodness as well. There are lots of other things these people can spend their money on. So I think we're uniquely fortunate to have people with a lot of money and a connection to this community and a long time horizon, not looking for immediate returns. I think that long view is essential to both this Foundation for Excellence, but also to the Kalamazoo Promise.
Michelle Miller Adams, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Michelle Miller Adams is a research fellow at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo and a political science professor at Grand Valley State University. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Issues of race are never far from the center of the national conversation. Relations between minority communities and the police and the use of loaded racial language in politics are a couple of recent examples. The Racial Healing Initiative of the Society for History and Racial Equity is holding its summit on racism tomorrow at Kalamazoo Valley Community College. Donna Odom is Executive Director of the Society for History and Racial Equity, also known as SHARE. Donna Odom, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So for someone who has never been before, please tell me what happens at the Summit on Racism.
Yeah, well, it's actually changed over the years. We took over the summit in 2013. The YWCA had been doing it up to that time. And the first year we were, you know, very happy if we were going to get 50 people. We were very excited about it. And, you know, we had conversations on various aspects of housing, health, education, that kind of thing. And then, you know, we went over our number that year. Then in 2014 and 15, it just grew and grew. And so finally this year, we decided instead of a half day that we had in the past, we would have a full day. One of the things that people ask for a lot is just more time to talk. So we do have a plenary session in the morning that goes to 10:30. And then after that, people can break out into sessions, smaller breakout sessions. And those will actually go for 2 hours. In the afternoon, before the second breakout sessions, we'll have a networking lunch. And then in the afternoon, we'll repeat those same sessions so that people will have the opportunity, if they can do the full day, to do 2 actual breakout sessions.
What does that response tell you, that you have more people wanting to come to the Summit on Racism? It seems like every year you're getting a better response.
Yeah. Well, it's very encouraging because one of the things that we want to do is to help people become more comfortable talking about issues of race, to help them become more aware of what is happening around the country. Now, obviously, this year we have an even higher response because of recent events, and we expect to have a lot of people coming in, maybe a little despondent, maybe looking for answers. And, you know, we obviously don't have all the answers, but we hope that we can work together during the summit to come to some kind of, some way of feeling as though we can go out and take action.
If somebody just heard us talking there and thinks, oh my gosh, this place is going to be so packed, I won't be able to get in, I guess I'll find something else to do on Friday, what would you tell them?
I wouldn't discourage them. Because as I said, the morning session that goes to 10:30, starts at 8:30, will have an opportunity for everybody. We have a very large room, holds over 400 people, and they'll be able to take part in that. There are 2 panels that will happen that morning. One is presenting some young people who are kind of our emerging leaders, we're calling them, and that session is hosted by the Kalamazoo Community Foundation. And then the second session is a session on racial equity and giving reports that various organizations have done on racial equity, including Kellogg Foundation, the Michigan Department of Civil Rights, and our own Lewis Walker Institute.
You say that you want to get people more comfortable talking about race. As you look back over time, since the Summit on Racism started, and maybe in particular when your group took it over, do you think that people have become more uncomfortable, not necessarily because of what you're doing, but just because of the events surrounding race and all that it encompasses?
Yeah. Well, what we say is that we want you to be comfortable feeling uncomfortable. And the idea is that we're talking about subjects that, don't make you feel warm and fuzzy, but we have to talk about them and we have to connect with one another. And that's one of our main goals, is to help people connect with one another. So it's not just the summit that helps us do that. We also have activities throughout the year that give people an opportunity to come and, share their stories and share their feelings about race and matters of race.
How important is it to be flexible when you're putting on something like this, that there can be events that happen, a week maybe before you're going to meet, and they seem like there's something that requires attention?
Yeah, it's important to be very flexible. And one of the things that we did this time was to actually send out a Survey Monkey pre-evaluation. And we shared the results of that with all of the moderators and facilitators. And hopefully, they'll use that to inform their sessions.
What do people want to talk about? Can you give us an idea?
A couple of them were pretty strong. But most people just want to find a way that they can fit themselves into taking some kind of action, to doing something. And they want to feel like they can, relate to other people better. And they want to help members of their family and other people reach that point as well.
Race is, of course, an ongoing story in America, an ongoing challenge. But yet, year to year, do you find that you are dealing with different things, that there are different subjects within the realm of race, which for one reason or another are maybe more on the public consciousness at that time?
Yeah. Well, definitely we've seen a real rise in the whole concern about police-community relations. That you know, it's definitely something that has come up very recently. And just in the last couple of weeks, the last week, I guess we'd say, the whole subject of bullying in the schools, you know, as a result of people feeling more emboldened, you know, kids feeling more emboldened to say things to people of other races or religions. So, yeah, that's become even more important.
This election obviously provides a lot of things to talk about. Mm-hmm. How do you do that in a way, to use your words, to make people feel comfortable being uncomfortable?
Well, first you have to, in my case, I've had a lot of my friends calling, and I think they're calling to hope that I can tell them something that's going to make them feel better. And my response has been, I've got nothing. But we are helping people in a way that what we try to do is help them tell their own stories, tell how they really feel, you know, express their feelings. And we use a set of what we call boundary markers. And those really encourage people to truly listen to one another, which often we don't do, and really try to connect with the other person in their feelings. We do that a lot with the retreats that we do. And the response that we've gotten is that it has helped people to be able to relate to folks on just a more human level rather than seeing the stereotype that they have of the other. So I think that that helps.
I would think that someone who signs up and attends something called the Summit on Racism probably sees this a certain way. Are you also encouraging that person who attends the Summit on Racism to try to be open-minded when perhaps they're at Thanksgiving dinner and their relative, who may talk a bit like Archie Bunker does, for people who remember the show All in the Family back in the 70s, to try and at least listen with an open mind when that person is stating their opinion?
Yeah, absolutely. And we get a lot of people who come to our discussions and say, I've got a relative, you know, who? And, you know, we try to talk to them and help them think about how they can relate to that person. And you know, especially on Friday, we're going to be talking about, you know, just the idea of white allies. And one of our sessions is It Takes All of Us, White People and People of Color, in Alliance Against Racism. So the idea behind that is that people will really, when they see something, do something or say something. So if, you know, a very uncomfortable comment comes up at Thanksgiving dinner, that they won't sit there and be embarrassed like everybody else, but really kind of step up and say something that maybe helps folks think about what they're saying and what they're saying really means.
I suppose related to that, I wonder a little bit if the Summit on Racism and some of the regular meetings that you've been holding, is there a way to take that and reach a broader audience? Or are a lot of the people you're reaching, you know, maybe the problem the Democratic Party's having at the moment that they're facing, that you're wondering how to get that message to the broader community beyond people who, again, are already sort of on the side of being, you know, willing to stand up against racism.
Okay. Well, in the case on Friday, and I sent out an email to our moderators and facilitators and said exactly what you're saying. We often feel like we're preaching to the choir. Right now, that choir really needs a lot of rehearsing after what has happened. So we may on Friday be speaking to a lot of people who do feel the same way we do, but they need that encouragement. Once they have gotten beyond the way that they're feeling now, what we encourage people to do is step out, reach out, and try to bring someone else into the fold. You know, and I think a lot of people have been trying to do that. It's not easy, but you know, that is really what we encourage people to do.
If we are able to sit down again in about a year, what are some things that you would hope we might be talking about then, and maybe some things that have kind of at least faded into the background, if not been completely solved?
Well, I don't think it's going to be completely solved, but, you know, I'd like to feel like, you know, we have helped people to find ways that, you know, they can do something to help. You know, I've seen lots of lists all over the internet and articles talking about things that you can do. Volunteer, talk to people, march, you know, do whatever you can. You know, we talked about different kinds of actions that people can do. And sometimes action just means writing a letter or, you know, just stepping outside of your comfort zone. Action doesn't always mean doing something really drastic. So I'm hoping that, you know, next year I'll be able to say, I've had a lot of people tell me that they were able to make a difference one way or another.
Donna Odom, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Donna Odom is Executive Director of the Society for History and Racial Equity, or SHARE. SHARE's Racial Healing Initiative will hold the annual Summit on Racism tomorrow at Kalamazoo Valley Community College. You can find a link with more details at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.